Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. We're very excited to announce that we are changing our name to Wild Heart Meditation Center. You can stay subscribed to the podcast as you currently are, or if you choose to join us again at a later date in the future, just remember to search wherever you get your podcasts for Wild Heart Meditation Center. We're excited to be introducing new facilitators to our group and expanding our presence in our local community. Enjoy. Tonight I wanted to continue talking about the same topic I brought up last week, which is building up and breaking down the self. And this idea of, you know, how through spiritual practice we're kind of doing both of these things. We're trying to create a healthy sense of self, you know, building self-esteem and connections with others and, you know, finding purpose and meaning in our lives. And we're also trying to kind of look at the self with more introspection, how we think about ourselves, the stories we tell about ourselves in our lives, how we compare or measure up to others. And so I feel like this kind of, you know, common experience in Buddhist practice, this paradox of we're both building up a healthy sense of self, and we're also kind of breaking down who we think we are, the stories that the mind tells us about who we are and how we're doing. Building up the self is, like I said, developing self-esteem or a sense of belonging or self-purpose, which is essential for our psychological well-being. I talked about last week, you know, some of the research of developmental psychologists, three of them, Erickson, John Bowlby, and Mary Ainsworth especially, that looked at how our brains are wired to develop a sense of self through others from a very early age. So how we get our sense of security in the world. You know, have you noticed how we use the word insecure oftentimes to talk about how we feel in relationship? So our sense of safety really comes through security with others. Especially during the earliest ages, 0 to 1.5 years, you know, where we require consistent, predictable, and reliable proximity to our caregivers and attunement, which means eye contact with our caregivers. Emotion regulation from our caregivers, which is a sense of them being able to soothe us and tell us that we're safe in the world. And encouragement from our caregivers, which is that we are safe to explore the world around us, that they're going to be there when we come back. So those are the four things, really, that we require from our caregivers early, early on in our lives, is a sense of safety, which means proximity or closeness. Attunement, which means literal eye contact. Soothing, which means emotion regulation. And encouragement, which means autonomy to explore the world. Right? And that, last week I also talked about, as we progress through our life, these earliest experiences are influenced by later experiences. So then we go through the stage of adolescence, where Erickson talks about we develop a sense of identity. He calls it an intense exploration of personal values, beliefs, and goals. Right? So that's why adolescents are often, you know, rebelling against their parental values and are starting to, you know, dye their hair and pierce themselves and get tattoos and all these wonderful things. I picked up a few of these things along the way. You know, to get a sense of who we are outside of our family system, who we are uniquely in the world. And so it's a huge part of our neurobiology is to develop a sense of self, a sense of identity. You know, and it means that more than just becoming a person, it means feeling safe and secure. And so spiritual practice is, you know, one way that we want to build up the self, to develop security and support, right? This is why I think human beings created religions. If we just look at it from kind of a humanistic perspective, even if all of these religions we've created don't amount to anything in the end, I think what they do is they have a utility. They serve as some security, some stability, some support. And so I think the Buddha, being mostly a psychologist than a spiritualist, knew this about form and routine and practice, right? He called this word bhavana, cultivation, the cultivation or development of a spiritual path, of the Eightfold Path, you know, which is a holistic path of practice that helps us to feel a sense of, you know, groundedness in what we're doing here. So one way through spiritual practice that we develop or build up the self is practice, routine, and structure. You know, giving ourselves the gift of consistency. Just like with our caregivers, we need proximity. We need to be close to our spiritual practices. We need to be, you know, interested in, even if what they are changes, right? Being interested in having spiritual practices. Giving ourselves the gift of consistency, practice, routine, or structure. Also, we need to give ourselves the gift of accountability and community. So this is kind of the second part of safety that we develop as a kid, being seen. Being seen, or attunement in spiritual practice, I think this means making ourselves known in a community, having a sense of people that are also interested in doing the things that we're doing in our lives. Right? Not that they don't challenge us to do things differently too, but that's kind of the point, that we're able to practice in community to get accountability and support. Another reason why we develop spiritual practice is this kind of third reason, is to be soothed, or for the purpose of empathy, to develop self-compassion and compassion for others. Right, to be given opportunities where we get to practice forgiveness, where we get to practice compassion, where we get to practice kindness, non-harming, generosity. And the fourth category that infants need is to be encouraged. I feel like spiritual practice provides this in giving us endless curiosity to explore inner and outer worlds. Right? Especially the Buddhist practice is a contemplative practice, which means that we're constantly contemplating and reflecting on, you know, what is it like today to be you? You know, what is it like, what has it been like today to have a mind? Have you watched the mind wander? Did you see where it went today? You know, to be curious in our inner experience of thoughts and feelings, and also our outer experience of how we are engaging in our relationships. You know, how did we do at work today? So I find that these four kind of areas early on that build up a sense of self, which is safety or proximity, being seen or attuned with, being soothed or emotionally regulated, or being encouraged, which means being able to explore, that these same four things are, you know, I feel like I find in spiritual practice. We create a sense of, you know, consistency and reliability ourselves by committing to, you know, show up day after day with others and to, you know, question and investigate our thoughts and behaviors. So this is building up the self through, you know, what we're doing here, giving us more security. Yeah, but we're also paradoxically, like I said, aiming to, through spiritual practice, break down the self. For example, examining the illusions and delusions of the self. You know, like we can become self-centered. You ever feel like the world is happening to you, at you, on you? You know? It's not unique. I mean, we cannot help but be self-centered, because the brain's survival system is always self-referencing. It's saying, what's happening to me? Am I okay? How am I doing? Am I safe? Am I comfortable? Am I happy? You know, and so we're always I, me. It's not our fault. That's just kind of what the brain does. But we can get in this delusion that the world is actually happening to us. That the things that we come in contact with throughout our day are landing on this person I call me. Examining the illusions and delusions of the self. Breaking down the self also through looking at how our self-identity can become too rigid. You know, like how we kind of take stances and we fix ourselves to our views of who we are. And also how our sense of self can become overly inflated and deflated, oftentimes on the same day. Right? I'm the got all my shit figured out. I'm on top of the world. I'm calm and confident and capable and strong and attractive and good looking. I'm great. Right? And then the next moment something happens and I'm the complete opposite. You know, I'm an unattractive, you know, uncaring, unintelligent, un-everything type of person today. So this is what we want to break down, is these kind of, you know, this sense of living with the self at the center, and also this self-view that gets constructed. Last week, one of the ways that I talked about breaking down the self was looking at how we put ourselves sometimes too far into roles or occupations or relationships or political and social stances, how so much of our identity can rest into these roles that we occupy. You know, we build up large parts of our identity into kind of singular places. The Buddha called this bhava tanha, which means craving to become. That the we got to watch the mind, because it's kind of always looking for some identity to inhabit, to say, I am, you know, I am single, you know, which sometimes can be a good I am, and sometimes can be a bad I am, you know, but I am, that sense of who we are being defined by our roles, our occupation, our relationships, our political, social beliefs. And so here's the nuance in really examining or breaking down the self, is that we're not trying to get rid of roles. We actually need roles. So these roles are good. But it's our clinging to the roles. It's how strongly we bind ourselves to these roles. Because the roles in and of themselves are impermanent roles. They change. And this is why I talked about last week. Like, we have words like midlife crisis. Well, why do you have a midlife crisis? Well, because who you are, who you were, you know, usually once your kids move out, if you have kids or whatever, and you reach 40 or 50 or, you know, whenever. I feel like I've already been through two midlife crises. But, you know, our sense of who we are changes. Or the empty nest syndrome. You know, if you're used to being the mother and your role is the mother, and you're so much of your day-to-day life is in that role, and then that role, what it means to be a mother changes, right? If you, any of you all have kids, I don't, but I work with kids and I work with their parents. You know, that what it means to be a parent changes. I've noticed that with my parents. My relationship to my parents has changed drastically. And so the nuance here is that we're not trying to get rid of having roles, but how do we fix ourselves to these roles and identify with these roles as who we are? And really, I guess if there's a practice here, it's to develop an integrated person that has several selves, right? That we have multiple roles. We have multiple parts of ourselves. And that we can express ourselves freely in those roles. And we're also looking at this kind of other layer of breaking down the self, examining the illusions and the delusions of the self through spiritual practice, is breaking down the tyranny of our all too common negative self-made stories. And so this means the kind of critical voice in our mind. You know, this has been a lot of Brené Brown's work on looking at core shame, which is an infection in our Western society.
You mean it's believed to be an infection, or it is?
Well, I would say it is. I would say it is. Yeah, the kind of, I like the word tyranny. It means cruel or oppressive rule. How we often, you know, without even noticing it sometimes, fall into criticism and judgment and comparison. So much of our sense of self is built on how we compare to others or how we compare to our ideal self that we need to become or improve. Self-improvement, right? If you even think about that, self-improvement, there's a lot of suffering in self-improvement because there's some type of kind of way or taste of that implies that maybe I don't have what I need. You know, that if somehow I was to just fix myself from what I'm broken of, then I could, you know, be the person I wanted to be. You know, in cognitive behavioral therapy, they call this negative self-talk. I think that's just an easy way to start to notice. You know, some people maybe don't relate as much to having the inner tyrant, the oppressive, critical, judgmental voice in their mind. I think if we look close enough, you can see the negative talk in the mind, right? That person in here that just doesn't seem to ever think that we're doing good enough. And so the practice here is that with mindfulness, we can start to become more attuned to the inner messages that run in the background of our mind throughout the day. And beyond just noticing the stories, right, that we tell ourselves about ourselves, we also can notice the tone of our inner voice, right? I think I said this last week. One of the things that helps me to think about the tone of our inner voice is like when I would come home and I'd been out past my curfew and my mom would say my name and she wouldn't say anything else. She'd just say, Andrew, and I'd know what was going down just by the tone, right? And we all have the voice in our mind throughout the day, the kind of inner narrator that's running around just yammering on and on and on about everything. You know, this neurotic kind of planner and organizer. And if you can actually look into the tone of the voice, you can get a sense of the aversiveness of the inner narrator sometimes. And mindfulness helps us to stand back, right? I mean, this is one of the kind of primary insights that we develop through practicing meditation, is you start to see your mind not as so much as my mind, but as the mind. It's the voice, the tone, it's the story that I can observe, or that the awareness, rather, can know, instead of who I am. We start to take the mind a little bit less personally. And so I want to talk a little bit tonight, a little bit of a deeper exploration of the self and breaking down the self, and highlighting one of the Buddhist teachings on anatta. Anatta is a very important or fundamental reflection, really. It's a practice. It's not a belief. It's not a philosophy. So this is kind of hard. But it's a investigation or a reflection into what about the self causes us to suffer. So the best thing I can say here, I said last week too, is that when translated, anatta means something like not self. So the word not, dash self. And the way that I like to define it as a practice, as a reflection, just to remember that who we are is a verb, not a noun. So I like to use this as a kind of simple way to get in the water with this topic, is thinking about the word human being. Human being. What does it mean to be being something? Well, it means that that thing's continuous. That thing's, you know, it's not the end of the story. The being is being beinged. Right? We're continuing to evolve. Who we are is a verb, not a noun. What we are is a process, not a person. All right? So just kind of think about that. And it's important to remember, perhaps you're new to Buddhism, that the Buddha wasn't a proclaimer of ontological truth. Ontology just means the nature of reality. He was not interested in what is, as far as the material world goes, what exists, what's real. He was interested in what we experience, which is called phenomenology. What he means by this here is that how do we experience the sense of self? We often think of the self as who we are, but really what the self is a dynamic, ever-changing process. It's a learning mind. It's a feeling body. It's an impacted, emotional, relational being as a verb. So I like to say, what are we being as humans? We're being impacted by our world. We're sensitive beings. I used to take this as an insult. People call me sensitive. And then I found out that that's kind of the goal of being a human, because you have 5 senses and your job's to live in them and understand them and learn from them. Right? So the more sensitive, with wisdom, right? With wisdom, the more we can understand how we're impacted by our direct experience, how we're stirred up or moved by our experience, and how we act out or react to our experience. And so what I want to talk about is this process of the self. Like, how do we start to explore what it means to be impacted, to be sensitive, and to be, you know, to be moved by our life and to, you know, engage with our lives. So the Buddha talked about our sense of self in terms of what he called the 5 aggregates. Well, we call them the 5 aggregates, which is a pretty boring definition. aggregate, really what this meant in Pali Sanskrit, the word was khandas. And what khandas means is bundles or heaps. And so he said that, you know, who we are experientially is kind of the coming together of five things. Rupa, which is form, material form, body, the elements of the body. Feeling, vedana. Perception, sanya. Inclination and impulses, which is sankhara. And vijnana, which is consciousness. And so don't worry if this sounds heavy lifting. We'll get into it. But what the Buddha says is that we're really, you know, how we experience the self is it arises, our sense of who we are, from the combining or the coming together of these bundles of things. So he says in each moment, you know, we're kind of making contact with our world, we're experiencing feeling and perception, we're having impulses, and we're knowing the experience. He says, and that's kind of what we are. And it's important, again, to remember that the way that we're looking at the aggregates is through the lens of mindfulness. So that means that with mindfulness, we want to really understand moment to moment how feeling impacts us, how our perception, our views about the present experience impact us, how our impulses to react to the present experience impact us, right? And how we act and react impacts us. So I like to say that the self that's being created in each moment is a self that's based on temporary feelings, temporary perceptions, and passing moods and attitudes. Like I said earlier, have you ever felt like you've been doing everything right in your life and that you've been doing everything wrong in your life in one day? You know, what these are oftentimes are moods coming to trick us, or the stories that the mind tells us, you know, or experiences and situations that we perceive we're stuck in, and some we are, right? But it's what we're looking at here is how our feelings, our perceptions, and our impulses kind of solidify into the sense of who we are. So we'll go through it. This is kind of a momentary breakdown of what the human being is, the verb of the self. In each moment throughout our day, we kind of have make contact with the world through six sense bases. So there are really six things in each moment that we can be noticing. That could be a sight, a smell, a taste, a feeling, a thought, a sound. I think I forgot to say sound. So the five senses plus thoughts. In each moment, the attention, you know, is making contact with one of these six things. As we make contact with our world through these six senses, the five plus the mind. Well, let me back up. So have you noticed during meditation that, you know, your attention can be drawn into thoughts? You know, that the thoughts are very powerful thoughts, that the thoughts have a lot of feeling to them. Right, so that's why the Buddha includes the thought, you know, thoughts as one of our six sense bases, because we're sensitive to thoughts, just like we're sensitive to sights and smells and tastes and sounds and feelings. We're also sensitive to thoughts. So in each moment, we kind of, our attention is, you can just think of this kind of like frame of awareness. And sights and smells and tastes and feelings and sounds and thoughts are all kind of running through this field. And so this is like, you know, milliseconds of experience that this is happening in. Now, anything that registers in this kind of frame of awareness as pleasant might grab our attention. Anything that registers in this field of awareness as unpleasant might grab our attention. If it doesn't register, it's probably not strong enough, so it's somewhat neutral. Right? That thing, that contact with that sound is loud enough to probably grab our attention. You know, we might have a pleasant association with the bell. Or if you're one of Pavlov's dogs, you may get hungry when you hear the bell. Right? So we have different associations with sense experience. You hear the clicking noise during the meditation tonight? You know, and then the kind of feeling of, oh, I'd rather that not be happening right now. And probably the thought, oh, that's probably going to keep happening throughout the whole meditation, and then I'm just going to be sitting here with the clicking noise, and I came to meditate, and now there's this clicking. And what happened in a moment of experience is the raw data of sound came through your eardrums, right? And the unpleasant feeling. Now, simultaneously, there's kind of perception, which is the meaning maker of the mind, which is maybe you hear the sound and you think, you know, first I thought maybe it was someone's phone or something. So that's the meaning that my mind assigned to the sound. You see, that happens automatically. You don't have to think about it, right? But then after I heard it again, I listened more and I thought, I had a thought, so then I made contact with a thought. It was a relatively neutral thought, but it was a thought about seeing a car out there earlier this morning, parked out front. And I thought about the car, and then I thought about, oh, it might be that broken down car. That's probably what's happening out there, right? And so I'm practicing meditation, so my inclination or my impulse wasn't to go fix it or change it. I wanted to. My body and my mind wanted to get rid of the sound. I actually thought about the neighbor, and I thought maybe it was one of his cars that had broken down, and maybe I'll talk to him about it. So that was my impulse or my inclination. So this is like what the aggregate system is we make contact with an experience, and then that experience gives us two things. It gives us perception, which is, what is it? And then it gives us feeling, which is, how is it? So each moment of experience, the sense fields are open, like I said during the meditation practice. When something lands in the sense field, we get a sense of what is it, how is it, and then what to do about it. So that's the third category up top, which is inclination or impulses. So you may have, you know, hear the sound, think of the car, and then you may get filled with a mental state, which might be a mood or an attitude or an emotion. If it's pleasant, there's some really good ways to track this. There's going to be a sense of wanting in the mind. Liking, wanting, moving towards. You know, if you're sitting in meditation and you think about, you know, a TV show you're watching and how you're going to go home and watch the finale, and there's this kind of like sense of maybe leaning into that thought. You're going to want to indulge in the thought a little bit longer, right? If you think about, you have payday tomorrow. I don't know who gets paid on Monday, but you get paid tomorrow, and then you're thinking about all the shit that you wanted to buy, and that thought comes into the mind, pleasant, perception, payday, money, dollar signs, inclination. You're going to want to indulge in the thought and maybe run with it and think about it more, hold it in the mind a little bit longer. You may even, if you're sitting at home, you know, get up from the meditation cushion. So the inclination, the mental state or emotion or attitude or mood may actually turn into an action. So if you're sitting at home, you start thinking about payday, and then you're thinking about, you know, you got to buy all these Christmas presents or whatever, and then you're like, oh shoot, I forgot to buy my nephew a Christmas present. And then you get up off the meditation cushion just that quick. A thought, had a feeling, right? It meant something. and it inclined you to react. So, what we want to look out for is kind of how we get the sense of self wrapped up in all of this. You know, the problem with this experience is that if we don't have mindfulness, we move through the aggregates automatically. And automatically means if it's pleasant, we'll crave and cling for it. We'll cling on to it. We'll move towards it. We'll indulge in it automatically. If it's unpleasant, we'll resist it. We'll push against it. We'll try to get rid of it. With mindfulness, we can start to see moment to moment, not as nuanced as this system, maybe. Maybe if you go on 2 or 3 months of retreat, you can start to really see moment to moment what the attention, what the sense field is bringing up, and the feeling and the perception and how it's inclining you to react. You can start to see that. On retreat, you can start to see a really, you know, this slows down a little bit. But in our waking life, the important thing here is that we can start to practice mindfulness, especially between our impulses and our reactions. Right, so I can see that moment when I'm sitting in meditation where I think the thought about the Christmas present and I want to get up and get off the cushion. And I can see that moment and I can tell my own mind gently and kindly, not right now. Just take a moment. Let that thought go. Right, I can learn to break the addiction to my thinking mind, to its reactive habits of getting pleasure and avoiding pain, of fixing and managing and controlling every part of experience, even though I can't fix and control. Right? We can influence the present, but when we get too caught up in our unconscious reactions, we fight against what is. We fight against our discomfort instead of learning how to cooperate with discomfort. We fight against the mundane, ordinary boredom we have and experience. Instead, we fight to get pleasure, to sensory stimulate ourselves all the time with new conversations and new sounds and new sights and smells. And so the Buddha said, there's no problem in pleasant things. He said, it's in our craving or clinging. It's our attachment to these things. And so I want to give kind of another example of this. I call it fixation. And this is where we kind of start talking about the self a little bit. And then we'll open it up. Fixation is the habit of unconsciously or consciously relating to people, places, and things based on previous information. So one example I like to give of this is this example of eating a strawberry. So let's say for some weird reason, you've never had a strawberry in your life, right? But you've heard from other people, strawberries are fucking delicious, right? So you want to have a strawberry, but you just, for some weird reason, you've never had the opportunity to eat a strawberry. And then one day, you get the opportunity to eat a strawberry. Your friend comes up and they say, I just bought, Kroger had a sale, got a bunch of strawberries. They're in my fridge. You can have one. You think, you hear that, I should say, right? You hear that, your perception, oh, strawberry, inclination. This is great. I want a strawberry. And so you move your body, impulse, and you go up and you get a strawberry. You open the fridge, you see the strawberry, pleasant. It looks red, perception, red, right? You now know this is what a strawberry is. Okay, it's a red thing. Inclination, I'm going to eat it. I've heard the red thing is good. And so then you take a bite of the strawberry and yuck. It's an old, one of those mushy, dark red strawberries. And plus, your friend didn't tell you you shouldn't eat the green thing on the end of the strawberry either. So now, not only did you eat a mushy, dark red strawberry, you ate the green thing, the texture's weird, it tastes bad, right? So your perception, how you make meaning out of the strawberry, is now unpleasant. Don't like strawberries. Right? And so, in the example of a strawberry, this is pretty uneventful. Right? It just means, well, maybe you'll go throughout the rest of your life, you'll never have a strawberry. But we do the same thing where we put a singular impression that we have of something onto the object. We say, this is what strawberry is, unpleasant. And we do this with people. And we do this with places. And we do this with things. And we do this with experiences, consciously and unconsciously. One way that I like to describe it, to kind of break it down in a simple way, is identity imprisonment, where we unconsciously imprison people, places, or things to past experiences. You know, so we had an experience with someone that we met at work, and they were bossy or rude, and that person becomes that identity. So you see, their self, who they are, got imprisoned in this experience. And we do this to ourselves too, right? We have experiences ourselves that we fix ourselves to. You know, we can have a resentment towards someone, and the resentment, the actual experience, is 5, 10, 15, 20 years old. The experience is a long time gone, but the impression, the perception, right? The meaning we assign to that person or that experience still lives. And it still may impact our mood. So you may just think about this person and feel the unpleasant perception of who they are and what they did, and we may feel the resentment. You know, we may categorize this person as one of those people. And then one of those people's like all of those people that do that thing that this person did, and then we don't interact with those people. You know, this is how things like racism, right, on a very simple level, you know, something someone heard, something someone experienced one time, something, you know, someone was told or whatever. Seeing a color, you know, associating identity to that. I call this identity imprisonment. The other thing we want to look out for is when we interact with a person, place, or thing, expecting that person, place, or thing will be the same as they were last time, but they've changed. You know, and so you see this a lot with relationships. You know, interesting thing is, like, you say you're in a relationship. A relationship is, it's a verb. Right? It's a ever-evolving, changing thing. But we don't always so much like when the people we're in relationships with change. You know, I've seen this in kind of had a lesson of humility around this with, you know, getting married and getting a home. And, you know, my wife and I are interested in having a family, and, like, I put off this responsibility for years. I finally found the right person and didn't know I would ever want that, but now I do, and that changed, right? I remember when some of my other friends, you know, got partners or kids or whatever, homes, and their life, the way that they related to me changed. They weren't as available or, you know, whatever. I didn't like that so much. Because they were the person that I was used to being able to be around all the time, or, you know. And we know this, yeah, people change, right? But we kind of have these expectations, these perceptions of people like they were before. And we have a hard time, you know, getting outside of the box that solidifies around people. A simple way of describing this is like if you go back to a restaurant, you ate at a restaurant one time, you had a wonderful plate of food, and it was just so good, and you're like, oh my God, this restaurant's amazing. You tell everyone about it, go to this restaurant, it's so good. Get the, you know, ravioli, handmade, it's amazing. Best ravioli I've ever had. And then you go back, different wait staff, different cook, same recipe, right? Different day. Who knows? Maybe someone got there a little bit later, right? Someone didn't, I don't know, was hungover. The cook was hungover. Who knows? But for whatever reason, this time, it's a little bit cold. Right? You take a bite, and it's not as good as you remembered it. And so these kind of, that's another kind of pedestrian example. But when this involves people, right, or things in our lives or situations, what the Buddha is really encouraging us to do here is to start to develop what's called insight, which is looking at, you know, how when we're not looking, the mind, regardless of whether we want it to or not, creates perceptions. It reacts to feelings. It says things like, I am awful. I am the best. I am smart. I am dumb. You know, and then we get to look moment to moment into what's actually, what's the process of what's happening, not the content. And the process means, what is the thought that came up in the moment? What was the experience? What was the, when you talked to that person, what was the nonverbal feeling you got from them? You know, what was their tone? How did you interpret it? How did you react to it? How did it continue long after it was gone? And this isn't to say that we don't, you know, have a sense of self. That's not what the Buddha is saying. He's saying that who we are is changing. Each moment we're being impacted, stirred up, and we're reacting. Each moment we're being impacted, stirred up, and we're able to bear mindfulness into the moment to observe the experience and to choose our response. Each moment we can notice the thought, we can notice the feeling, we can notice the perception or the view we have. We can notice our impulses. And awareness is where all the power is in mindfulness. You know? So, some thoughts. This could really go